This is Jack Cobb with Maury County Public Schools and the Big Yellow School Bus. You're listening to Front Porch Radio on 101.7 WKOM in Columbia, Tennessee.
Attention radio listeners. Mother's Day is around the corner. So are graduations, confirmations, birthdays, and more. This is Jenny at Tillis Jewelry, and we are here to help. Not only have we created a fun new collection of birthstone stack rings handmade in-house, but if you get here in time, we can even get special items made in time for your event. Ask us about our posh new travel jewelry case, available for a limited time. Tillis Jewelry, your friendly hometown jewelers at 105 West 7th Street in Columbia.
Hey, this is Derek Ransom with Ten Pin Alley, voted number one family entertainment center in Maury County. We offer 32 bowling lanes, giant arcade, laser tag, bumper cars, and a full cafe and bar menu. We also specialize in group events, kids and adult birthday parties, company parties, sports team parties, and holiday parties. We're located at 322 East James Campbell Boulevard in Columbia. Call us today at 931-381-BOWL or visit us at tenpin.com. Ten Pin Alley, it's where the good times roll.
Minutes matter when you call 911 for a heart attack, and Maury Regional Health is ready to care for you. Utilizing the state-of-the-art cardiac cath lab at Maury Regional Medical Center, our team of expert cardiologists and experienced clinical professionals are equipped to investigate heart conditions quickly and perform life-saving interventional procedures. Go to murrayregional.com/heart to learn more. And remember, always dial 911 when you or someone near you is experiencing heart attack symptoms. Maury Regional Health, where clinical excellence meets compassionate care.
Hi, I'm Matt Perales, manager of Maury County Equipment. We help you with all your agriculture and construction equipment needs. We carry a full line of New Holland tractors from compacts to high horsepower. We have a full line of Gravely mowing equipment. We also have New Holland construction equipment, attachments, and accessories for your tractors and a complete parts department. We are locally owned and operated. Come see us at 1075 North James Campbell Boulevard or learn about us on Facebook or contact us at 931-490-8183.
Maury County volunteer firefighters provide fire and rescue services to Maury County residents like you. I'm Savannah Madison, Public Information Officer with Maury County Fire. Our department serves over 600 square miles, and as a volunteer department, we rely on community donations to operate. You can also support by joining our department. We help you obtain the certifications to become a support member or firefighter. Learn more about making a tax-deductible donation or becoming a firefighter at murraycountyfiretn.org. That's murraycountyfiretn.org.
Hello, my name is Zach Maddox. I'm a proud third-generation owner-operator of Columbia Paint and Wall Cover, founded by my grandfather, Ralph Maddox, in 1946. Now I am honored to continue the legacy as owner-operator today. We offer a variety of paint and wall covering products, but our passion is customer service. We can offer many personalized services and can come out to your house or business if needed. Visit us at our store downtown Columbia at 1114 Carmack Boulevard or online at paintcolumbia.com.
Do you have trees that need trimming or removed? Do you have stumps that you want grounded? A1 Tree Trimming and Removal is a family-owned and operated business local to Columbia and Lewisburg. They also service surrounding Middle Tennessee. We are licensed and insured and provide free estimates. No job is too big, no tree is too small. Give old Luke a call or text Luke at 931-993-5441 or check us out on Facebook and tell A1 Tree Removal that you heard this ad on the radio. If you love America, you will love A1 Tree Removal.
The generations that have paved the way for us deserve respect, integrity, and compassion. This is Kelly Dobson, owner of Caring Hearts Home Healthcare. My grandmother and mother started this business in 2005, and I was honored to take over in 2012. Licensed and insured, we help our aging community stay in the comfort of their own homes. Online at caringheartshomehealthcarellc.com, by phone 931-381-5470, or in person at 1121 Trotwood Avenue here in Columbia. That's Caring Hearts Home Healthcare.
We always get the question, what is Caledonia? That's easy. We're a full financial services firm. Who is Caledonia? Well, that's a little more interesting. Monty has an economics background. Daisy and Perry come from the banking world. Gay is an accountant. And Thomas has science and business degrees. Blair was a small business owner. Finally, I'm Becky Price, and I have a background in education. Together, we make up Caledonian Financial in historic downtown Columbia.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through NBC Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
Do you want to give back to an individual with disability? disabilities and help change a life, the Guide Dog Foundation and America's Vet Dogs are seeking volunteers to help raise future guide or service dogs. Puppy Raisers provide loving homes for puppies until they are old enough to begin formal training. Help raise an adorable pup into a future guide or service dog for a person who is blind, visually impaired, a veteran, or a first responder. Visit puppy.guidedog.org to learn more. That's guidedog.org. Sponsored by the Guide Dog Foundation.
Thank you for tuning in. It's time for this week's episode of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. Take it away, Tom.
Good morning and welcome to History's Hook, where I guarantee that we'll get you hooked on history. I'm your host, Tom Price. Each week on History's Hook, we'll be bringing you interesting and informative stories from the past in an effort to connect the history in our own backyard to the big events that compose national and world history. We'll explore a new topic every week and bring in experts and eyewitnesses to the events and places we'll be talking about. This is not your high school history class. We're going to make history fun and compelling. We're going to get you hooked. Today, I am honored to have with us Sandra Seaton. A Maury County native, Ms. Seaton is an award-winning author, playwright, and librettist. Her plays have been performed in cities throughout the country, including New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and her libretto for the solo opera From the Diary of Sally Hemings, set to the music by Pulitzer Prize, Grammy Award-winning 2007 Composer of the Year winner William Balcom, has been performed at such venues as Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, the Herbst Theater in San Francisco, and the Rialto Performing Arts Center in Atlanta. She received the Mark Twain Award from the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature in 2012. She taught creative writing and African-American literature at Central Michigan University for 15 years as a professor of English. Ms. Seaton, welcome to History's Hook.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom, for inviting me. This is quite a pleasure. Thanks so much.
The honor is ours. I'm also joined in the studio by my co-host, Maury County historian Joanne McClellan. Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Joanne. Great to hear your voice.
Ms. Seaton, before we get into your impressive career, I'd like to spend some time on your family and your childhood years in Columbia, Tennessee. Your family goes back several generations here. You've studied your family history. What can you tell us about your family origins here in Columbia and in Maury County?
Well, I was born at 904 East End Street, I was born in the same house that my mother was born in and my grandmother was born in, and possibly in same room. I can't testify on that. But my grandfather, Will, was a noted fisherman in Columbia in Middle Sea and took all kinds of fishing, took FDR fishing when he came to the area, took Cordell Hell fishing, the owners of WLAT, the doctors from the Harry and, the Ridley, Will Ridley, Major Frierson were fishing buddies of his. So he was well known in the area. My great grandmother's husband, John, was the chef at the old Bethel Hotel. And he also was a cook at Columbia Military Academy. His wife, my great grandmother, Emma Hatcher, was the child of a member of the Hatcher family, and she lived there until she married, and she's the child of John Hatcher of the Hatcher family. They were had a very large estate in Columbia. And this was always something I knew. And when I asked my Aunt Gladys over the phone, when I was interviewing her, she whispered his name, John Hatcher. It was something that was never discussed, but she was very close to the family. And when there was a funeral, anything of that sort, they'd always come to get her. I know I was told by my Aunt Camille and Uncle Randy that they would take her out there and she would sit with them all day and then they'd bring her back.
Hmm. I think the estate is called Blythewood. Is that correct?
Blythewood. Right. Thank you. That's it. She was born there up on the third floor of the big house, as my aunt would say. Wow. And she was given an allowance even after she married, because my grandmother used to say that on Saturdays they would go up the office of a family member, it might have been attorney or whatever, and would get money. Says, here I am. Here's money for the children. So those things happen. You know, I'm sure it's not a unique story. This is a truly American story.
Absolutely.
And then my father, Albert Brown, was a teacher. His father was a teacher and principal, Sam Brown. People that might still know that name. He was pretty strict, and you know, nobody wanted to go to his office. Let's put it that way.
A principal at what school?
He was principal at College Hill at one point, a teacher at College Hill, and he was also a principal in Mount Pleasant School.
That was the Clark Training High School.
Mm-hmm.
Was the Clark Training School?
He was also there.
Okay.
And that was in Nashville, right?
I think Clark was in Mount Pleasant.
on Mount Pleasant, yep. Right? He was there too. And in the summers, he taught at Fisk. And I do know that he was murdered in his backyard in Nashville, and no one ever found found out who did that.
Wow.
And that was something that my father, who was Albert Sampson Brown Jr., that was a lifelong thing of his to try to find out what happened.
How
there.
Old was your father when his father was killed?
My grandfather died before I was born, and I want to say okay, my father went to Fisk. He started there when he was 15, graduated when he was 18. That was in 1933. And I think I have the record somewhere, but my grandfather passed away in, I want to say, 1938.
Hmm.
And that really changed life for my father, who was, I think, was planning to go on to be a doctor, but ended up going into business in real estate, not here, but in Ohio. I do know one thing about my grandfather is that early on in a now defunct Columbia paper, and I have a copy of it, he wrote a poem chronicling, celebrating the life of his father, Charles O'Reilly Brown, who was a minister in Columbia. It's a very beautiful poem. And I think that the newspaper, and I can't remember the name right now, was something, a paper that was much admired by the African American community.
Huh. So creativity and creative writing sounds like it's a generational theme within your family.
Yes, my grandmother, Emma, was very much the declaimer. She went around reciting Paul Laurence Dunbar at churches, at weddings, at teas. She would play ragtime piano at some of the parties and festivities and church fundraisers. And she did minstrel shows. She was the end man. And then her friend Rebecca Johnson, Herb Johnson's mother, was the interlocutor. They did those.
Huh.
So. And the reason I mention that is because another relative of mine, Flournoy Miller, went on to Broadway and wrote the book for Shuffle Along with U.B. Blake. He went to Fisk and made quite a name for himself there.
Right. Mr. Miller has actually been, we've talked about him in a previous episode of History's Hook, very influential in early black entertainment. Let's
That's
talk
right.
about him for just a minute. It sounds like he was a real influence on your grandmother. And by extension, you as well.
That's right.
He wrote the is it a play? Is that how it began? Shuffle Along,
uh-huh.
or a musical? And one of the famous songs. I remember my parents singing the song when I was a kid. I'm Just Wild About Harry, who sort of became quite a famous and popular song. But Shuffle Along is hugely influential. After its launch, it launched the careers of such notables as Josephine Baker, the first black woman to star in a major motion picture, Paul Robeson, the great opera star and activist as well. They're all influenced by Shuffle Along, which you're...
Florence Mills. William Grant Still was in the orchestra, the famed African-American composer was in the orchestra, and it was there was a revival of it on Broadway a couple years ago, the making Shuffle Along and the making of the musical with Fabian Glover doing choreography. I was actually invited to attend the rehearsal, but I couldn't make it because my husband failed. It's had quite an influence. And Irving Miller, Flournoy Miller's brother, and also Quintard Miller, they were also quite influential in their time.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about them because when I was studying Flournoy, I found out that his brothers were also involved. What about their connection to the Amos and Andy story?
Well, Amos and Andy, he wrote, well, Flournoy Miller, as far as I know, I used to read about it quite a bit, and I haven't really read that much about it lately. He wrote quite a few of the early scripts for it, and it's kind of a complicated story, and there are a lot of ins and outs to it.
I know that Flournoy also was nominated for a Tony Award, I think, posthumously for his work. I love these stories that sort of go generationally, where you can pick up these themes within a family, and certainly creative writing and music are one of those themes in your family.
I want to say that I was told by Olive, my cousin Olivette, his daughter, that he wrote Who's On First for Abbott and Costello.
Wow.
And if amazing. if you listen to it, it does sound a lot like a Flournoy Miller routine.
Yes.
And I know that comedians like, you know, Jack Benny and Milton Berle and Bob Hope revered Flournoy Miller because they thought he was just the master of that comedy style. And this is an interesting thing, a quote from my cousin Olivette, whose daughter, his daughter who worshipped her dad, said that what Shuffle Along was black people making fun of white people making fun of black people.
Right, yeah, right.
Interesting. What about their dad that was editor of the newspaper here, the Nashville Globe?
You mean Lee Miller?
Yes.
Well, I don't know a lot about Lee Miller, but I do know that I know he's from Columbia. He went to Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church, and his wife, Elizabeth, went there, too. I have a big collection of old Nashville Globes, and that's where you see Lee Miller's name a lot.
Right.
Lee and W.D. Kelly of the Kelly family started a black paper in Columbia that I've never seen a copy of. It's called, I believe, the Columbia Spotlight. Hmm. And and somewhere there's got to be a copy of that paper somewhere. I've never seen one, and it doesn't seem to be in any archives.
Not yet. We'll keep an eye out for it, certainly.
An eye out for the Columbia Spotlight.
Your parents divorced when you were still quite young, and you and your mother moved to Chicago's West Side. Why Chicago?
Right. But I want to say before that, growing up in Columbia, my earliest memories were of my mother and her bridge club, the Bridgettes, and that was a very important part of my life.
Describe why. Why was that such an influence on you, that group?
Well, I just remember the women, the way they were dressed, the food, and I was allowed to be there, and it was a communal gathering. At that time, I didn't realize how realize it, but they were very elegant, and it was as if they were going into this very, very special world. And
I want to talk more about this when we get into the play,
sure,
The Bridge
sure,
Party.
Sure.
I think that will be a wonderful time to talk about it. Talk about Chicago. Sure. Why did you move to Chicago? What brought you there?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with it. It was never. My mother divorced my father when I was quite young, and when she married my stepfather, we moved to Chicago, and it was a real culture shock. A small town like Columbia, where everybody knows everybody, you smile and see people walking down the street, and so I did go back to Columbia for first and second and third grade. So I moved there for a while from the time I was 4 and 5, and then I came back to Columbia for first, second, third grade. First grade teacher was Mrs. Hawthorne, Dr. Hawthorne's wife. Second grade teacher was my aunt Ruth Whitaker, the mother of Jean Whitaker. And third grade teacher was my aunt Camille Howell. And so that was a really great time for me, idyllic. And then I went back to Chicago again and went to high school there, elementary school through high school there. It was a rough world. I made friends, and I had a great time making friends. And, you know, going to museums, doing all kinds of cultural things. But it was never the same as being in Columbia with family.
When you were in Columbia, did you attend College Hill? Was that your elementary school?
Yes, I went to College Hill. Mr. Porter was my mother's first boyfriend. She was either my mother's first boyfriend or second boyfriend. It was Mr. Porter and Mr. Kimes was her. Those were her two high school sweethearts, Edward Kimes and Horace Porter. And, So, and I went to College Hill, and of course knew Mr. Porter very well. I would stop by his office and say good morning, Mr. Porter.
Sandra, I think I told you this once before. When your mom was teaching out at the Theodore Rosenwald School, she lived she lived with my grandparents, and Mr. Kimes came out to visit her.
Oh, wow.
My mom told me that.
Which Rosenwald school do you think that would have been?
It's the Theda Rosenwald School in Theda. Theda.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, Theda, I remember my mother talking about Theda, and I wonder if she taught at Center Star also.
I have not seen a record where she was at Center Star, but I'll look because I've researched all of those schools. And, you know, my grandpa.
When I was a little girl, when I lived when we were still in Columbia, my mother would take me out to school with her. And that was my earliest education going out there. And I remember doing that.
Wow. I know when I came back here, I played bridge with the bridge group in the 2000s. And of course, you know, Mrs. Kimes and Mrs. Howell were still members. And I can imagine mm-hmm. what that group would have been like 60 years earlier, because when I got here, they had been, you know, they had organized like 60 years before that. So I can imagine what
That's
the group
right.
would have been like with all of the other women. But I enjoyed the time that I spent playing bridge with Mrs. Kimes. And Mrs. Howell, and you know, Mrs. Kimes was my grandmother's first cousin, so I had strong family ties
Wonderful
with the
woman.
Kimes family. Yeah,
Miss Seaton, when did you begin writing creatively?
You know, before I mention that, I just want to say the other thing I forgot to mention was Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church, because my family, you might mention this later, founded that church in 1843 along with, they were three of the seven founders, but that might come in later, right? Yeah, we can talk about that later, I think.
Sure.
You were asking about...
About how old were you when you started writing creatively?
Oh my goodness. Well, Well, you know, my grandmother would always have me recite. When people would come over, she'd have some poems she wanted me to recite. And then when I got to Chicago, I was in elementary school. I had a teacher named Ann Barzell, who was a dance critic of the Chicago American. And there was a little paper called The Pentagram, and I would write for that. And as far as formally, at the University of Illinois, so after I graduated from Farragut High School in Chicago, I went to University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. I was the first person in my family to go that didn't go to an HBCU, and they couldn't figure that out, but I went anyway. They even had a little meeting about it, but because everybody else had gone to Tennessee A&I or FISC, you know, like, what is she doing here? So I went to University of Illinois, and I was going to be a journalist. And after taking, you know, a few of the journalism courses, I realized that there was this pull to creative writing. So I started taking the creative writing courses, and I ended up majoring in creative writing. And I did also take a playwriting course there from a guy named Webb Smalley, Mr. Smalley, and he was very encouraging. So that was my first serious attempt at being a creative writer when I took those courses at Illinois. And I studied with John Frederick Nim, who was the who helped start Bread Loaf with Robert Frost and John Sciardi. Mr. Nims also was the editor of Poetry Magazine for a while when Henry Rago was on leave. So I think I had some pretty good teachers. And as far as the poetry goes, Mr. Nim was outstanding in what he was able to pass on to me. And, you know, it was that coupled with my background, my own family background. And I think the two of those two things stayed with me.
It's really fascinating how you combined your life experience and then having these connections with these pretty renowned writers and poets in the period that are sort of making your career blossom. You did graduate work at Michigan State, is that correct?
Yes, and that was in creative writing also. I took a graduate seminar with Robert Martin's Arthur Miller Scholar, and read all of Arthur Miller's work. And he was my thesis director, and I wrote The Bridge Party as a part of my thesis. And as a matter of fact, he had invited Arthur Miller there while I was there, so I did get to him. It was very nice.
Really? Wow. What an opportunity.
And yeah, and so I did a lot of writing as a graduate student, too, and just kept on writing.
We will, I want to get into your career. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Miss Sandra Seaton.
Don't go away. History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, will be right back after this brief commercial break.
Celebrate you with a new vehicle from Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram of Columbia. We have a huge selection of new vehicles waiting for you. We're talking cars, trucks, and SUVs. And if you're in the business of selling your vehicle, we've got you covered. We'll buy from you even if you don't buy from us. At Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram of Columbia, we're locally owned and operated and proud to serve our community as the largest CDJR dealership in Tennessee. Find your new ride today when you visit Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram of Columbia.
Hi, Terry Tillis from Tillis Jewelry. Art Deco period jewelry is classic, and we carry some beautiful rings, necklaces, and earrings. Art Deco fashion was one of the major artistic influences in the 1920s and 30s. The look has endured till today. Stop by Tillis Jewelry and see for yourself our collection of engagement rings to beautiful necklaces. I'm sure we'll find a special piece just for you.
Tillis Jewelry, downtown Columbia, owned and operated by Rick, custom designer, and Terry, registered gemologist, assuring you the best jewelry value and expert services.
American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning is built to a higher standard, so you can focus on the problems in your life that actually matter, like the stair that only creaks when everyone else in the house is asleep. American Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, built to a higher standard.
Call Davis Heating and Cooling at 931-388-2090 for all your home comfort needs. Davis Heating and Cooling is your local American Standard dealer and proudly serves the Maury County area. Find Davis Heating and Cooling online and on Facebook or call today, 388-2090.
Are you thinking about a new fence? Maybe you need a pole barn. Then you should give Sands Fence Company a call. That's 931-309-1644. Will Sands has built his business based on the principles of honesty, quality, and integrity. Sands Fence Company has been in business for over 20 years, providing the community with farm, residential, and commercial fencing, as well as pole barns and buildings. Call today for a free estimate. Sands Fence Company, 931-309-1644. 931-309-1644.
This is Delk Kennedy. Years ago, my wife, Mary Susan, was repeatedly lifting babies. She ruptured a disc in her back. She had surgery, but the chronic pain continued. Then she found the Dr. Gill Center for Back, Neck, and Chronic Pain Relief in Franklin, Tennessee. It changed our lives. She's had a relatively pain-free life. She sees Dr. Wendy Tuohy at the Dr. Gill Center regularly. You can, too. Call 615-794-0800. That's 615-794-0800. Or go to calldrgilltn.com.
This is Debbie Matthews with the Nashville Realty Group, and if you've been paying attention, you know the housing market has been tough, but rates are beginning to thaw. So if you're thinking about selling, the time to jump in is getting better every day. But if you're thinking about buying, and those interest rates are still a little bit too high, a good agent knows how to negotiate interest rate buy-downs, and I'm a good agent. So call me, Debbie Matthews with Nashville Realty Group, 615-476-3224.
This is Clayton Harris, and you're listening to 101.7 WKOM Columbia.
History's Hook with your host, Tom Price, is back. Take it away, Tom.
Welcome back to History's Hook. Today, we are having a conversation with Miss Sandra Seaton, a librettist, an award-winning librettist and author, who hailed originally from Columbia, Tennessee, and went on to really great fame for some of her plays and other things that she's written. Miss Seaton, you are the author of 10 plays. Your first was The Bridge Party, whose setting is the meeting of an African-American women's bridge club in a fictional small Tennessee town called Delphi in the 1940s. Now, you've already mentioned briefly one of your earliest, most influential memories is watching these women in the bridge party. The women are based on actual people who are then living in Columbia. It's interesting to me that you fictionalized the name of the town, but you kept a lot of the people's names who are actually living here. What was your thought process behind that?
Well, I'm not sure why. I think maybe at some point I was thinking about creating this fictional world. My mother was alive, and she didn't like the idea of my writing about anything personal. And she wanted more of the name change in the bridge party. And one night, I remember sending the play to her, and she was changing names and crossing out lines and putting in her own lines. And then she sent it back to me, and she said, oh, I stayed up all night rewriting that play. I kept a couple of her lines, but I kept the name. But she was great. And, of course, when she got to see Ruby Dee do the play at University of Michigan, and I think that changed her mind. And she was in the play, and And I kept talking about how the way she was. I said, well, you're a star, Mom. You're just a star. And she was fine after that.
So these ladies that you remember as a child growing up here in the Bridge Club had a marked impact on you. And it seems to me you're really trying to recreate sort of that culture in the play, The Bridge Party. It's beautifully written. I think you mentioned in the book that the understated style of your writing comes from a couple of different forms. So the story sort of unfolds very slowly. And that understated style comes from foreign films that you watched while you were in college. I found that very fascinating. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, when I was in college at Illinois, they had the Film Society, and there were the New Wave films. And if you know anything about, the pace is fairly slow. And there's a big emphasis on, getting into the individual characters. It's the close-up. And one thing I thought was missing in portrayals of African-Americans, I thought a lot of it was cliche and just not much of an effort to humanize. And you didn't see, you saw these movies about white women who were very elegant and were leading complicated lives, but this was usually with the African American women who was the maid or who the cook or who cared for the children would have a few lines and very often comic. And really, it wasn't really who these people actually were in real life. The people playing the roles very often, they were outstanding actors, actresses, but I just wanted to do something more to show, to humanize African American women and show that they had complicated lives, and that's why I wrote the play, The Bridge Party, and it was their reaction to an incident that I was familiar with, and I'd always heard about Cordy Cheek as a child, and that's all anybody ever said was they mentioned it, but it was always there. And I wanted to have it there in the play to show the reaction of the women to it. But knowing them, I knew that they would not, because this is something, that particular type of thing, it's not that it happened all the time, but they lived in a time when there was always the threat of a racist incident. And so what this shows was the way they were able to persevere and find meaningful lives in spite of it, because otherwise there wouldn't have been an African-American, any kind of African-American life. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it does.
And reading the play is an amazing experience for me. You're raising several points that I'd like to talk about a little bit. Your story unfolds subtly. It's full of the rich vernacular of these African-American women of the 1940s, with wonderful descriptions of the design of the room. You go into great detail, the books on the table, specific books on the table, what these ladies would have been reading in the time, their character, their attire, the food that they eat, the aromas that you probably remember as a child attending one of these. It's really, really wonderful. It really draws the reader in, and I'm dying to see this on stage because I think it would develop this even so much more. But it draws the reader into this world, at least for me, a 50-year-old white man. It draws me into this world that's really quite foreign to me, but comfortable at the same time. I don't know if that makes any sense whatsoever, but there's sort of this maternalism in this room, this community in this room that I've not experienced in my own life, which I find very attractive. Their dialogue speaks to events in the culture of the time. The key event, as you're talking about, is awaiting the return of Cordy Cheek, who is an actual figure in history, an 18-year-old boy who was accused of raping a white girl, was acquitted by a jury, and then was lynched. A horrible crime in that time period, an actual event that took place here. So again, I'm intrigued that you're using sort of somewhat fictionalism, but combining it with real history. What prompted you to write about Cordy Cheek in this setting? Why that specific event?
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That is such an interesting question because, if you're an African American, you history is such a big part of your life, and there's no way to detach yourself from it. It's as if, you're going on a trip, and you have this horse-drawn carriage, and you say, well, I'm going to go on the trip, but I'm going to detach this horse from the carriage. Well, you don't go anywhere. You just stand there, right? You just stay there. And that's what happens, I think, if you try to write without being hitched up.
Right.
If that makes sense.
It does.
So it was just something that came naturally. And ideas as a writer, I've had commissions where I've said, no, you know, with the Sally Hemings piece, we want you to write about Sally Hemings. I didn't pick that, but I was very interested in it. But writing on my own, where do ideas come from? You know, that's an interesting thought. I can't say, looking back now, where that particular one came, but I think the idea of the horse and the horse carriage and them being hooked together to take you to that destination, maybe what
the Cordy Cheek lynching hit a chord on a larger scale. His death was the chief discussion topic on college campuses across the nation in 1933. No less than the great poet and author Langston Hughes wrote about him. I think this event really struck a chord on a national level in 1933, and of course is going to culminate in another event that you write a little bit about or allude to at the end of this play. Events unfold slowly and elegantly in this play. We learn about these women. We learn about their lives and to some degree their history. As you said, history is so much an important part of who we are, and I think you do a beautiful job in doing that in the form of a play. They are strong women, obviously. When confronted with white authority in the form of local police, they show the expected deference, but you make it clear in your writing that they are in charge of the situation. They're playing out a scenario that they've dealt with for a long time. They're navigating a racist world and succeeding in it. Can you speak to that a little bit? Is that part of your own experience as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is because... They were relatives of mine. I've talked to my own relatives when they were alive. None of them are there now. About their confrontations with police during the Columbia race riot, not because of the race resistance, or however we would want to call it, and about the way they finessed when they were confronted with the National Guard or the police that were there, and just sort of got around them that way because. When you're dealing with armed people, then you have to be clever. And I knew that from my own grandmother, who was very good at that sort of thing. I was watching her, and one of my aunts who was out that night of the race riot, and was walking down the street, and the NASCAR came up to her and asked her where she was going. And she said something like, born and bred in a briar patch. She said, well, go on. And that was that. But by the same token, they would have been the same ones that would have given money to have Thurgood Marshall come to town and would have helped in any way they could with the resistance. One of my earliest memories, and speaking about memories, was my mother. When my mother was a teacher, she must have been teaching at Theta, and she was, we didn't have a car, but she would drive out there. I was in the car with her at that time. This was in 46. I was there with her, and Mary Morton's son, Jimmy Morton, was going out there to school with us because, you know, the schools were K-12. At least that's the way I remember them. You know, there were people of all ages there, right? So Jimmy must have been in the trunk the whole time. When we got to the funeral home, and this is really, and, you know, kids know when something is going on that you could, what I remember is that the tension was so thick you could cut it. I mean, you could cut it. I mean, it was just, you know, and children know this, animals know this, you just know this sort of thing when something's going on. So we got to the Morton funeral home. They opened the trunk. Jimmy gets out and runs in the house. And I remember that for the rest of my life because they were so afraid of this young black man being harmed. And I said, was that Jimmy or something? Yep. And he was running in the house. And that's how things were that night.
Was this the day of the situation in Columbia? Was it the February 25th when that was happening?
Well, you know, I must have been 3 or 4 years old. Okay. So that's all I remember because, you know, I know that the young men were being, being arrested and this sort of thing. And the Mortons, of course, were already involved. But I think all that had a big effect on me when I was writing The Bridge Party.
It's amazing. The Bridge Party was performed at the University of Michigan, starring, as you said, the late actress Ruby Dee. What was it like seeing your work performed on stage for the first time?
Oh, my goodness. It was wonderful. It was sort of an out-of-body experience, because the thing about collaborating is once it's almost as if it leaves you and then you see it there and you know it's a part of you. It's magical, because when you hear words that have been on the page, when you see them come to life, that's really fascinating. That's incredible. And that people are able to deal with them and improvise. We had a really great cast that night. Besides Ruby Dee, there were a lot of veteran L.A. Actresses who came along for the ride. When they heard Ruby Dee was going to be in the play, it was just it was quite amazing.
I would think that it would make you feel vulnerable at the same time. You're putting a part of yourself out there for these people to see and experience.
Well, I guess the vulnerability starts when you write it in the first place. That's when I really felt more vulnerable. And then you're vulnerable when you give it to somebody to read, to say you've read it and you think highly of it. You know, you just never know. And then when the Glenda Dickerson, who was the director, said, "Oh yeah, I want to do this," then you feel less vulnerable. I guess you're right, though. There still is that sense of vulnerability.
Another play that you've written is called The Will, which also takes place in the fictional town of Delphi, Tennessee. This play is really a take on your own family story.
That's right. That's right. My great great grandmother and her great great and her parents, my great 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 grandparents. It was the great great was Eliza Webster, and the three greats were Annie and Dempsey Cherry. They were the three of the seven founders of Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church in 1843, and I wanted to bring their story to life. I had seen Cyrus's will and the beautiful writing. I had found his grave, their graves over at Greenwood, and I'd always heard this story from my Aunt Gladys, who was kind of the family historian after my grandmother had passed. I found a lot of things from my Aunt Gladys, who was a cook over at Carver Smith and a Sunday school superintendent, St. Paul, for 50 years, as long as she was alive, from the time she graduated high school, actually long that. But she told me the story about Israel, one of the 22 kids that Cyrus and Eliza had, at 14 lived to adulthood. She told me the story of how Israel had sassed a white man, and when the Klan came to look for him, Eliza had hid him under a mattress. And that story stayed with me. And so that's a part of the will, and what happened to Cyrus's son, Israel. So Israel is one of the characters in the play. And I just wanted to bring them back to life. And the story of this incredible person, Cyrus, I saw from his will, the beautifully written will, which is really a piece of literature. I wanted to know more about him. And I wanted to bring him back to life. And he was came to Columbia in 1830, and this during slavery was able to purchase land over at Bear Creek from the money that his family had given him. He was raised by what I believe to be abolitionist parents, relatives. He had a black mother and a white father. He was taught to read down in the basement. This I know from family stories. And when he was 18, they gave him money to start his own life, enough money to buy farmland. And he came to Columbia over by Bear Creek and bought land and raised tobacco. That I knew about him. And so I wanted to make a story about this young man in 1830 of African-American that was able to make a life for himself. I just thought this was fascinating. And so that's how the will came to be.
There was a real revelation to me in reading this, that what the will means to Cyrus, why he's spending time in writing this will. To modern people today, writing a will is not a big deal. It's something that's pretty standard. But for an African-American man in the late 1860s following the Civil War, the ability to write a legal document was important. And it's important to this character, this family member of yours, Cyrus, that he is leaving something behind, a legacy, and he has the ability to do it. That was a wonderful moment for me to come to that realization.
Thank you.
Sandra, I found a copy of his will, and I had heard about it when I first read your play a couple of years ago when you gave me copies. And I looked it up again, and it is beautifully written, but I noticed he left something to someone named Anderson Cheatham. And who was Anderson, and was he a relative?
Well, you know, these were all children of Cyrus. And one of the things I would really love to be able to do is to find out more about my relatives. And I know the Cheathams were in Nashville. There's a Cheatham family, Doc Cheatham, the musician. And I would really love to know more about the Cheathams.
This
could have been a grandson. This was probably a grandson.
Okay. The other thing that I have been researching on another project is like the atrocities committed by the KKK back in the 1860s. And I have this report that's like probably 100 pages. And I ran across an interview that was done with Anderson Cheatham. And he talked about...
Really?
Yes. And he talked about... I'll email it to you. He talked about how the KKK was looking for Israel. And Israel Webster
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. I'm looking at it right here. And
oh my goodness.
So Israel
is magical.
Israel is mentioned here in this interview, but I couldn't. And it mentioned that they were going to go to Israel's house. And this is probably where you wrote about his mom hit him under the bed. But before they went to the Webster house, they were at Cheatham's house. And it's like fascinating. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the same person that you were talking about in the will.
Oh.
I have been researching the atrocities because of another project that I'm working on. And this report was commissioned in 1868 by the Tennessee General Assembly.
Well, because, you know, I know about a few, you know, Cyrus and Eliza had 22 kids, and then around 7 of them died during smallpox. And the other ones, I know about, you know, a handful of them, but there are others I've just lost track of.
I mean, this is a fascinating part of Maury County history, I tell you.
Oh, my goodness. I would love it if you would share that with me.
I certainly will.
Miss Eaton, as always happens on History's Hook, we're running out of time. I want to spend the last minute or so talking about your work from the Diary of Sally Hemings, a libretto you wrote for that solo opera for the composer William Balcom. The fictional work is a depiction of the innermost thoughts of Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman of mixed race who is believed to have had a relationship with Thomas Jefferson. How did the project come about?
Well, it came about with Florence Cuivar, distinguished mezzo-soprano Florence Cuivar, who approached William Balcom and who wanted a piece about Sally Hemings. And then William Balcom turned to me and asked me if I would write the libretto. I'd never thought about writing about Sally Hemings, but then I thought about, you know, my own past, my great-grandmother Emma, who was a child of a hatcher, and did some research into the whole thing, and I agreed. And that's how I spent about a year doing firsthand research, going to archives. I didn't go to Monticello, and I hadn't met any of the attendants. But then at the premiere in 2001, the Library of Congress, they stay in touch with the Sally Hemings descendants in Monticello and the Library of Congress. They're connected, of course. And so 45 of the Sally Hemings descendants came to the premiere at Coolidge Auditorium, Library of Congress. And I got to meet them. And that's when I was vulnerable again, because I was worried about whether they'd approve of this, but they did. And I got a nice note back from a couple of them, Shea Banks and Julia Jefferson, saying, thank you for honoring our great, great, great grandma. Plus, they did like it. And so that really made it worthwhile.
It must have felt amazing. I know William Balcom was a little reticent at the beginning to take on this project, but after reading your libretto, was all in on it. He comments, and what a beautiful job you did. And a special challenge, I think, for you, that Sally Hemings never left any written word. So you had to create something from your own mind based on all of the research that you put together. It must have been an amazing challenge.
Well, here's the thing. I think going back to my play, The Bridge Party, what I wanted to do was to show another side of the African-American experience. I wanted to show this woman who, and I think there were probably many others like her, and, you know, just to present her as in a complicated manner. And one thing I did want to add about the Sally Hemings, the solo opera song cycle, is that this summer it was supposed to be performed at Glimmer Glass Opera in the Catskills, and it was canceled as a live performance, but Francesca Zambello, the artistic director of Glimmer Glass, created a video about it, which is 60 minutes in length, that I would be happy to share with you and your audience. And this was, as of August 27th, 29th, it was up on the Glimmer Glass website, and I was delighted with the performance by Alison Cambridge, and it has great set.
I've watched the entire thing on YouTube, so we'll put the link up on the website so people can enjoy it. Time today, but it's wonderful work. Sandra Seton, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Thank you for your contribution to the arts, to our nation.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you so much, Joanne. It's been an honor to be here with you. I'm a big admirer of your work, and also, you know, I'm from Columbia, Tennessee.
Right. And thank you. And I will send you that information, and maybe we can get the bridge party down here one day.
Well, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
I'll end the show with this quote. Because racism was then legally entrenched and publicly justified, it was a significant accomplishment to build a life with ceremonies and rituals affirming the integrity and importance of our own friendships and families, of our own lives. In my childhood memories of life in the South, the world of the personal and the private, of everyday life with its ups and downs, is particularly important. To me, this is a tribute to the tacit but adamant refusal of the grown-ups I knew to allow themselves to be defined by racism, but instead to live as full human beings, whatever the obstacles. Those are the words of our guest today, Sandra Seton. Join us again next week for another edition of History's Hook.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of History's Hook with your host, Tom Price. We hope you enjoyed today's show. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and again at 6 p.m. right here on WKOM 101.7 FM for a journey through time.
I'm Robert Rogers at Parks Motor Sales Buick GMC. Parks Motor Sales was founded by my granddad, Bobby Parks, and my great-granddad, Julian Mays, in 1958. We've been family-owned the whole time, and being family-owned, locally owned, means you get to get your next vehicle or your existing vehicle serviced by the same people who stand in the grocery line with you, drop their kids off at the same school you do, and smile and are happy to see you when they do. So come see us at Parks Motor Sales in Columbia, Tennessee on 919 Nashville Highway or parksmotorsales.com.
I'm Barbara Lincoln with Holland's Pharmacy. We have advertised with WKRM and WKOM for the past several years and found it to be very successful. I highly recommend advertising with them if you have a local business like ours. We're located at 1608 Hatcher Lane here in Columbia. We're open Monday through Friday from 8 to 6 and Saturdays from 8 to 2. Stop by Holland's for all your prescription needs, where we have fast, friendly, courteous service. We custom fit support hose for you also. Thanks for supporting Holland's and WKRM and WKOM.
Hi, I'm Steve, the garbage man. Are you new to Maury County? We want to welcome you and your family. We are a local residential garbage service, and we want to be your garbage man. We've been around for over 30 years, so we have a reputation. Check us out at garbagemaninc.com or call Mike at 931-540-0919. You could also ask your neighbor. 931-540-0919.
For 40 years, the Jewelers Bench has worked hard for their customers and provided the highest quality jewelry at the best price. They keep going back. Recent renovations have allowed them to expand their inventory. More high-quality jewelry, custom vintage and estate pieces, and professional jewelry and watch repairs. They also buy gold. The Jewelers Bench, still here, still great service. 808 Trotwood Avenue, Columbia.
Every morning, I park my car across the street from my business, and I can't wait to get in there. That's pretty common for small business owners. We have the added satisfaction, however, of guiding hundreds of families with their retirement, education, savings, and general investments. We're a locally owned business that tries very hard to simplify a complicated world. This is Monty Sneed from Caledonian Financial in historic downtown Columbia.
Securities and investment advisory services offered through NBC Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC.
Columbia Foodland is a locally owned and operated family grocery store with a full line of dry, dairy, frozen, meat, and produce items. We focus on keeping the freshest hand-cut meat and produce items daily with the most competitive prices in town. We offer weekly ad specials as well as in-store weekly specials throughout the store. Located at 427 West 7th Street in Columbia in the former Harris Foodland location. Columbia Foodland. We are here and ready to serve the wonderful people of Columbia and the surrounding areas.
Hello, my name is Connor Mims. My wife Bradley and I live in Columbia, Tennessee in Riverside. I am a deck and porch builder and my wife is a second grade teacher at Riverside Elementary. My specialty is designing and building elegant and comfortable porches and decks. Let me work with you to design and build the porch or deck of your dreams. Give us a call today from our website, MimsModernLandscape.com. That's MimsModernLandscape.com, and check out what we have to offer. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Zach Maddox. I'm a proud third-generation owner-operator of Columbia Paint and Wall Cover, founded by my grandfather, Ralph Maddox, in 1946. Now I am honored to continue the legacy as owner-operator today. We offer a variety of paint and wall covering products, but our passion is customer service. We can offer many personalized services and can come out to your house or business if needed. Visit us at our store downtown Columbia at 1114 Carmack Boulevard or online at paintcolumbia.com.
The Mules are back in town. For nearly 50 years, Mule Day funds have supported local schools, civic organizations, and improvements at the Maury County Park. Now Mule Day is working to positively impact the lives of young people in Maury County with the Mule Day Works Scholarship. Encourage young people to apply online at muleday.com/works or check it out to see how you can help support career and technical education in Maury County. Support Mule Day Works by attending Mule Day April 4th through the 7th. Visit muleday.com/works. That's muleday.com/works.
Are you prepared for what many experts believe to be an exponential tax increase when the Trump tax cuts end here soon? In addition to protecting your hard-earned money during your lifetime, what about college planning? Would you like to see an excellent alternative to the 529 plan? If you think you can do a better job of spending your money than the federal government, give us a call. Call us at 931-269-9520, 931-269-9520, or go to optimalfinancialplanning.com.
This is Sue Fox. Are you looking for a swimming pool for all seasons? Whether you want to lose weight or just give yourself much-needed therapy, water therapy is the perfect non-stress exercise for the body. Come to Fox & Company Salon and Day Spa and indulge in our heated lap pool, jacuzzi, and dry sauna. Just bring a swimsuit, towel, indoor footwear, and a friend. Call Fox & Company Salon and Day Spa today at 381-1773 or stop by 1211 Hatcher Lane for a tour. Oh, wait, ask about our new chair yoga sessions.
Farmer Johnny here, Taylor Family Farm. I want to give you all a little look-see. We raise 100% non-GMO grass-fed beef, pasture chicken, and pork on our family farm. Everything that we grow is raised with love and care to ensure the highest quality and nutrition for our family and customers. You can shop online at TaylorFamilyFarmTN.com or visit our farm store in person at Etheridge, Tennessee at 301 Dave Reisner Road. That's TaylorFamilyFarmTN.com for more information.
Hey Columbia, this is Trip from Trip's Ace Hardware. I'd like to invite you to our Spring Day and Remodel Celebration on Saturday, April 27th. We will have grilling demos, free food tastings, and a gift with any $10 purchase. come see our new store, new garden center, and all our new merchandise. We are located next to Legends on James Campbell Boulevard. I look forward to seeing you soon.
This is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
Debbie Matthews, realtor, and her husband Jason, who is a pro songwriter, also own a music publishing company. They live in historic downtown Columbia with their dogs. Dog rescue work is their passion project. They consider Middle Tennessee their backyard, and their lives are full of all things Tennessee. Debbie says there is no greater honor than to help someone find a home. To be trusted with that job, there is no greater privilege. Call Debbie at the Nashville Realty Group, 615-476-3224, 615-476-3224.
Hello, I'm Rick Whitley.
And I'm Daniel Pollard from Jones & Lang Sporting Goods. We would like to take this opportunity to thank all of you for the many years of support. Since 1966, Jones & Lang has been locally owned and operated and supplying teams from T-ball to college. Stop by and see what we can do for you. We offer a wide variety of services from silk screening and embroidery to our custom trophy and awards department.
We're open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and Saturday, 9 to noon. Remember, Jones & Lang Sporting Goods, the look of a winner.
Looking for convenience? Try Quick Mart Convenience Stores, conveniently located all across Murray County, southern Middle Tennessee, and North Alabama. Whether stopping in on your way to work for coffee and a biscuit, taking a plate lunch to go, or grabbing something cold to drink after a long, hot day at work, there's always one nearby. Quick Mart Convenience Stores, conveniently located all across southern Middle Tennessee and North Alabama. Proudly serving Shell Gasoline.